Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. Today, we're going to look into aerodynamics, a really cool study that was published on aerodynamics and cycling, super specific to all of our needs. We're going to talk about electrolytes and how we might be messing them up, improving standing power, lots of good stuff. But first things first, we should get into this question from Drew, and he submitted it at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can do the same if you're watching right now. It says, since it's Christmas time, what bike training things are on all of your Christmas lists that you want most? Also, if you guys already have all that you'd want, since you're sponsored athletes and industry people, what products don't exist that if they did exist would be on your Christmas list? Ventum Bikes and Trainer Road's Ivy Adrain first. Ivy, what say you? And Merry Christmas to everybody, we should say, that's listening to this. So
close. My real product list, I want another bike. What's one more, you know?
Which one?
So I've been riding my XC bike, the Santa Cruz Blur, with a bunch of my kind of trail bro buddies who have like big bikes, and I feel like I'm gonna die or hurt myself or break the bike. But it's really fun to ride more technical, steep stuff and kind of get into some of those like mellow baby drops and jumps and things. So I want a Santa Cruz Hightower. I think I'm making it happen. Ooh. And then I think with that, I should probably get another helmet, like a Bell 6 or MIPS, with more like rear coverage, like an actual mountain bike helmet instead of just, you know, a little XC helmet. Cause if I'm getting rowdy, I should probably protect myself a little bit better.
100%.
Yeah. And then real product list. And I already secured the bag on this one. I got a walk pad from Amazon.
What is that?
It's like a really low profile skinny treadmill. It's like pretty small, really light. And it was like $150 on Amazon. And I saw TikTok girls doing it. And it's so sick. It's like, because I love to.
Google this.
Yeah, they're awesome. The max speed is probably like 5 miles an hour. So I could gently jog if I wanted to, slow run. But they're just really quiet. And so I could just like work on my phone. And I love to walk for like an hour or more. It's just so nice. It's like one of the things that I miss about the gym in the winter. When I had a gym like across the street from me, it would get dark at 3. And I'd be like, well, what now? And so I would just go to this gym and walk and play on my phone. It was so nice. Because, I want to walk for, what if I want to walk for an hour and a half? It's like if I'm walking around town, then an hour and a half goes by and I'm like, okay, I'm done now, I want to be home. Well, gotta turn around and so anyways,
almost like Trainer Road.
Trainer,
remarkably familiar.
So it's just so nice to be able to like do that in my living room, and it's so like slim, so I can just slide it under the couch. It's super sick. So I treated myself to that for Christmas.
You went,
it's like a minimalistic treadmill.
Totally.
Does it even have a motor in it, or just all based on you?
No, there's like a motor. There's a motor, and it's super quiet. I love it.
I've seen people use those for like at the standing desk. They like, it's like they walk while they work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Walk like 15,000 steps just on this while they work.
Anyway,
so I like that. My not real wish list, for affordable gravel races.
Keep pushing, Ivy.
It's crazy. I'm just kind of like thinking about what kind of racing I want to do next year and what events I want to go to, and just bums me out that there are so many cool ones that I want to be a part of. And it's already so expensive to just be a competitive athlete, and then to actually get yourself to an event, and then the final barrier to entry is that registration is like $300. It's unbelievable. So I don't like that. I want more affordable gravel races.
Amen. Yeah.
How about you?
CEO Nate Pearson.
Oh, yeah, Nate.
Yeah, what's on your list, Nate?
Mine are, the first one is kind of there, but kind of not. I want like a really big road dropper post.
Yes.
Even for aero bikes. Because there's no reason why you'll descend so much better and be so much safer and feel awesome. And that when you go on turns, that feeling of like the road pushing back, it's so scary when you're like 4 meters from the like your bottom bracket versus like really close. It feels nice and it feels like you're on rails. But the farther you are from that, it's like a lever, and little like twitches or like bumps in the road, they get exaggerated and it's no fun.
I thought about this, Nate. I thought about you. Just last week, I saw a smart car going really fast down a mountain road, and I realized it's like it's taller than it is long. And then suddenly I found myself thinking about it. I'm like, whoa, that's the feeling that Nate has when he's on his bike. Because the tiny little smart car was like leaning all over the place, looking like he was going to tip over. And I was like, Nate's way taller than he is long because the wheelbase doesn't expand at the same rate that your height does, right, as the object on the bike. So like, it makes you less stable. That's how it works. Well, no, geez.
I don't know how.
Just give thumbs up again. Yeah.
I feel like a tall person has never really designed these bikes. You know, like they call it pink it and shrink it for women, mm-hmm. which is, you yeah. know, same, just make it bigger for tall people. But I think really the weighting's off and all that. And I don't know what mm-hmm. to do to make it better. And I bet some companies, Specialized says that they thought about it, but it just doesn't feel amazing. But a dropper post, when I do a dropper post, like on the Chamois Hagar, which is own like weird geometry, but I can't tell the difference between all the way up and all the way down descending. The fear like goes away. And then descending without mm-hmm. fear, you're more relaxed. You can respond quickly and it's awesome.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Next one. This will be world changing. So what I want, I don't know. here's the problem is that tracking like calories and macros, super hard. Super annoying. It takes forever. AI is getting so good. This is the complete system that I want. Something that can like watch with a camera what I'm cooking or just what I'm eating, you know, pulling out. It can identify that. Even if I put a tablespoon of butter in versus two tablespoons, it could look at that and understand it. After I eat my food too, look at it and understand that, you know, sees the plate. He only ate 2/3 of this and understand the ingredients that went in that because it cooked. I think this is all something that could happen. Understand those macros and calories and have it recorded. And then tie that in too with like what's in your refrigerator and pantry. And know mm-hmm. like some people have done this where you kind of start out with this set of food and you tell ChatGPT. And then as you move forward, it's like, oh, I used 8 eggs. You need more eggs. Something like that. And you can keep it going. And I think it can know that whole system. And that is what would be so nice. And maybe you could use your phone or something while you're traveling to upload this stuff to show just at least at the end, a video of like what you ate and what you didn't eat. And yeah, that'd be so cool. And there's all these people too, you know, like,
a dream.
Hey, I don't lose weight. I'm at 800 calories per day. Like, are you really at 800 calories per day? Let's see. Yeah. And it'd be nice. I think it would show a lot of clarity. When I did, like, all of us had, Ivy, have you tracked your macros before? You have, right? Mm-hmm. To detriment a little bit too far. Like
yeah.
all of us have.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the first time, like, it's really eye-opening, right? When you realize some of these ultra palatable processed foods, how much like fat and calories are packed in there that without the nutritional benefit. And mm-hmm. it's kind of crazy. Like maybe the AI too could just suggest. Creep.
I get portion creep yeah. over time. That's
eight,
like.
Eight Oreos so I check turn to 24.
In... yeah. Yeah. Sleeves. I can't remember if there's plural or not. Yeah. But I check in like once every 2 to 3 months. I'll do a week of like tracking. And it's not like Sunday to Sunday. It's roughly a week until I feel like the job's accomplished where I just like recalibrate myself again because certain things I'm not eating enough of and then certain things I'm eating too much of. And it's just, but I can't do it all the time. You know, Alex Wilde, he can't yeah. eat without measuring it. That actually does it for him. Like he's like mentally, that's good for him. That's what he likes. But for me, it ruins joy from food for me entirely.
It does. But also like, I feel like everyone should do it for just, you gotta be careful for disordered eating, but mm-hmm. just for a week and understand how many carbs are in different things. And I was actually eating way less carbs than I thought. And then I looked mm-hmm. at oatmeal, like oatmeal with raisins. Wow, did you know raisins really up the amount of sugar you have inside your oatmeal? And, you know, the tablespoon of olive oil, I was really putting in like 4 or 5 tablespoons of olive oil, and which is not a bad thing necessarily, but I just want to be able to understand that that's, you know, hundreds of more calories. When that might be the only deficit that I want to have during a day, which is nuts too.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea for folks to do it just for a week every once in a while. And I feel like I'm probably healthy enough to do that now. And I know that I need to because I'll like find a new thing at Trader Joe's that I really like and I'll fixate on it. And mm-hmm. I like want to eat it over and over and over
again. Tell
us. No. Well, this is new segment. Okay, the pork bao buns that you just like nuke in the microwave.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. Ooh. Amazing.
She's on TikTok.
Yeah, fill my freezer with them. Reviewed. I eat 100 of them. And then all of a sudden I'm like, when did I eat a vegetable last? And then I'll be like sick of them. And I won't eat them for, you know, 6 months. It's weird. So I should probably do that. Check in every once in a while to make sure I'm meeting my needs, you know.
And even if you just do it for a day, that will help. And I think MyFitnessPal, you pay for... I think you may have to pay for a whole month of $20 or something, but
you don't even have to pay for it. You can do the free version. You just can't customize like your macro ratios. It doesn't matter though, because you're tracking it. You're not setting out goals or anything else like that. So yeah, you can do it for
just
free.
Awareness. So mm-hmm. do some of your common meals, and then you need to scale too. But if it's like a box of something like pasta, you take a picture of that, you weigh it, and then you figure out what it is. And you kind of be really accurate just for one day, and then you get information about where you're at. And I bet most people aren't. I know I wasn't, at least. I wasn't yes. where I thought I was. And then it changed some habits. And now I also have some meals. I still remember kind of like general what they are. And they're really good. And I just kind of repeat them. And, you know, oatmeal with some nuts and the right amount of whole milk and stuff. I'm like, ooh, I really like this macro combination. Then my, you know, we'll talk about it in a second, the goals, but with a protein shake, and I can get just the right amount of protein and carbs and some fat, but not like blow it up like a yeah. Jimmy Dean sausage pancake, like, you know, the corn dogs. Trying to, my son's what? A little underweight, so I'm trying to give him more food. And, yeah, so it's a corn dog, but it's a sausage wrapped in pancake.
Oh my!
I just tried
gosh.
To give it to him now.
I gotta go to the store. I'll be right back.
Yeah, yeah no, it's not. That'd be one of those like. Not cycling foods. Yeah. I mean, you can't do it. You can eat it. Just don't. I wouldn't eat it like pork bowel buns.
Yeah, yeah. I want to share two things that I learn every time I measure food. And I obviously I don't learn them. I just become aware of them once again because it's like, wow. Number one, how easy it is to like take in way more calories than I anticipate just with fat. Like fat is everywhere. And it's funny because I have to work hard to make sure my protein's up to snuff, that sort of thing. I never have mm-hmm. to work hard to make sure the fat's up to snuff.
Never.
So. So that's one thing that I notice. Then the other thing that I notice every single time, I'm always shocked by it, is how many vegetables I can eat and still stay within a calorie goal and like macro goals. Like the amount of vegetables you can take in. And then once you start bringing in a bunch of different vegetables, like flavored differently and uniquely, makes for like really,
you feel
really
so
fun
good, right?
eating. Oh yeah, it's great. It's so good.
So you feel like, okay, so that's a good segue before we go on, John, sorry. How do you get in lots of vegetables? Probably 4 weeks in a row, I had like a Whole Foods giant spinach container that was never yeah. opened.
It just goes away.
And I was pretty good at making salads for a while. And I think what I'm going to do is in my protein shakes, just shove spinach in,
yeah.
like yep. a green smoothie thing. And try to get through a whole, like, I don't think what they're 12 ounces or something for a week yeah. or 20. I don't know.
You don't even have
it is,
to do
it's a
green
lot.
Smoothies. If you're doing like a chocolate peanut butter banana thing, I throw a whole bunch of green spinach in there and you can't even taste it. It just doesn't taste
good. Yeah, that's
anything.
What I need amazing. To do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Would you throw anything else in there for veggies before we go to John?
For veggies? Yeah. Oh, no. Just, stuff like
not
kale.
Carrots and.
It tastes like bitter. Yeah. So yeah. just spinach. Just spinach. Doesn't taste like anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's awesome.
Good for nitrates too.
I throw in spring mix into a lot of my stuff too. Like I get spring mix instead of spinach because it's more versatile. So then that way, if I just buy a huge thing of spinach, it's just that. My spring mix has a mix. And you can throw in spring mix into a blender of any sort of smoothie and you can't tell. It's just like more fibrous basically.
Really?
Like what it feels like when you're drinking. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it better nutrition profile than, I guess, you know, variety is what's important too. So
it's just variety. Yeah. And my fear is that it may not be as much as just eating spinach, but at the same time, if I eat a lot of this that does contain spinach and everything else, then I'm probably going to end up okay, you know? So.
Spring mix can be good too with like a, you know, chicken and rice bowl or anything. Oh. You just kind of put it in that bowl and you make it into a, yeah, that's, it's hard to do sometimes though. Cause
my tips to get the veggies
improve
in,
improve the flavor. Yeah.
Saute it is super easy. And then you can throw that in and adds a unique texture or anything else to a lot of food. Cause when you saute it. Yeah, yeah. If you saute it, like add it in, like let's say you're cooking some vegetables and some meat in the pan or something like that, you've cubed up stuff where you have frozen veggies. That's one of the best ways to get veggies in is buy frozen veggies beforehand. And if you go to a place like Trader Joe's or anything else, you'll find more than just like frozen potatoes that you'll find at a normal grocery store. They'll have like a wider variety, which is nice. But get frozen veggies and then throw them into a pan. And when you're doing that, just throw in your spring mix too. So then when it cooks down for a bit, you just have a little bit more. And then a giant pan full of spring mix turns out to be like the size of like a quarter. It cooks down really, really well. But then that's a good way to get it in, throw it into smoothies. And then I have like a personal goal that I set in last year, which we'll talk about goals next episode that we record next. That'll air around New Year time.
Okay.
But,
I was ready.
With that, I know. Well, good. We'll be ready for the next week. But I set a goal to have like a salad a day. That was the goal. I was not perfect on that, but it was like my stretch goal and I just reached for it. So then that way I can have like the spring mix in the normal condition. I can have it sauteed. I can throw it into the blend or the smoothie. And then it's really easy to make sure that I'm getting enough greens. So it's a good way to do it.
I have another vegetable tip. And this is a very real thing. No shame to these adults that do not want to eat vegetables. We talk about salads and roasted veggies and adding greens to stuff. And some people are just like chicky nuggy people and don't want that. And just like yeah. simple red sauce spaghetti people. My and son. That's okay too. Yeah. So for your son, I mean, you should
me saute, too at heart. For sure.
Saute some like zucchinis and carrots in a pan until they just get like soft, and then put them in a blender with red sauce. It's still red. They can't even tell. They won't even taste them. So if you're an adult that doesn't want to eat raw veggies like that or cooked veggies, you can just blend them up with red sauce, put it in your spaghetti. You won't even know.
Pay someone else to do it for you so you don't know. My son only does butter pasta. Butter pasta.
Don't blind. Don't blindfold yourself and cook and blend. That would be a bad idea. Please
don't do that. John, I want to hear more about the sauteed veggies. And before we get to that too, I want to say the thing that, so I have to, when I cook, I also cook for kids. So it's a whole nother like constraint to it. But you say frozen stuff, but man, fresh broccoli is pretty cheap and you have to get a steamer. You get a steamer and you put that on. It's like 6-7 minutes and you got it. You can get it just perfect. Salt and pepper. Kids will eat it. It's amazing. You could put butter on it too for kids. My kids are both, you know, I'm really big, but they're still under the 50 percentile for weight and they could just eat as much. So I could doctor it up with whatever I want. Not that you should really care about how big your kids are unless there's a doctor tells you. So don't even worry about what I just said. But yes, just always have some like two heads of broccoli and I always do it with, twice a week, I think. And I haven't gotten tired of it yet.
Yeah.
So how do you saute? What do you saute? Because it's hard to get all the, sorry, Abby.
Yeah.
Get all the ratios right so that that's the right tenderness and crispiness. Get put in order, like carrots versus onions.
So typically, if you have anything like an onion or like a sweet pepper or anything else like that you're putting in, I put those in first because they take a long time to cook down. We air fry most of our potatoes and starchy vegetables. That like makes them crispy and delicious, and it serves as a nice contrast to what you're sauteing in a lot of cases. And then you throw in the greens about it. Really, honestly, if you're cooking anything below medium heat, like in a normal pan, then you can throw in greens and within a time course of 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, it's going to be cooked down to the point where it's not just like a black little charred biscuit of vegetable, but it's going to be cooked down and it's just like a textural element at that point. And it ceases to add a whole lot of like flavor. The cool thing is though, and this is a tip from you, Nate, from years ago, this is drifting off from our Christmas list, but hopefully it's just practical advice for it. Nate, you had mentioned like getting a bunch of different sauces and like flavored sauces and just like having those there. That's one of the best parts about sauteing your greens is that they can take on that flavor of whatever you're sauteing with. So I'll throw in like mushrooms, I'll throw in like onions, mushrooms, some sweet peppers, some jalapenos, something like that. And then you have almost like a scramble mix of vegetables. You air fry some like sweet potatoes or normal potatoes. Then you throw in the greens. And then throw in something like, there's like this really good Chipotle style, like a spicy marinade that I use that we get from Trader Joe's, and it's delicious. And throw that in there.
This is a Trader Joe's ad brought to you by Trader Joe's.
Yeah, seriously. So that's how I do it there. But yeah.
Is that a side dish or do you mix stuff into it too sometimes? Like do you mix into it or is it like you have a chicken?
I'm a bowl eater. I'm like a bowl eater. So I take all that and I take whatever I'm having and I always put it into a bowl. But for our kids, it's different. This is probably diverging a bit. But the one thing we always do with our kids is that I try to never force them to eat something. I always ask them to try it. And then if they don't like it after they try it, it's okay. And that in some cases, what's that?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry, in some cases, that means that the next day or the next week or something else, Simon tries the same thing he didn't like last week, but he just tries it once. And then it's pretty cool though, because that was like an advice from a friend of ours and it broke down a lot of barriers. So now Simon's just totally open to trying anything he'll try stuff. And that doesn't necessarily mean that he'll eat it all, but I also don't want to obligate him into eating everything, but we can't do a bowl with him. He's got to have everything separated into its own space. And it's a huge, huge key.
So on the podcast, so many parents, right? So I think this is relevant and cooking for yourself and kids, and people might be parents in the future. With my son, the trying thing, do you ever get where Simon just goes, no, I don't want to try it? Because he's like that on every, but if I want him to try it, he will not try it. I have to just like, I don't know. It's like a cat trying to get inside. You put the milk down and run away and just see if they like drink a little bit on the camera. My son likes hot dog. I'm good for, send me tips. Like, put in the forum, let's get some tips. Because he does like
butter noodles.
Butter noodles, hot dogs, corn dogs, bagels. He will eat carrots. So I can get him to eat like a little bit of broccoli. And the crazy thing is that what his favorite is filet mignon. that, like that.
Of
and
course
then, like,
it is. Of course it is.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's going to be lobster too is the next one.
I had a college roommate like that.
I'm like, he doesn't eat anything. Like rather than corn dog, okay, I'll do that.
My college roommate ate so Flaming Hot Cheetos, drank Hawaiian Punch, and T-bone steaks, and that was his entire diet the whole time as a college. My college roommate. It was wild.
Is he live? So, is he with us?
Yeah. Yeah. He's doing great. He was a water polo athlete, super good athlete. So yeah, it can work. But Nate, a lot of the time, it's at odds, right? Because you're trying to cook this food that's going to give you fuel and energy for your workouts, and then you've got to feed your family, and it feels like it's at odds, and it's tough to do. Two tips, and you might already do these things, Nate, but two things that have helped us too, sometimes Simon just says no. Involve Simon in the shopping. And I go, Simon, we need ground beef. Which one should we pick? And then he picks out whichever one. Then he takes pride in the fact that he did that. And then I ask him, how do you want to cook that? And then I involve him in cooking it. And that does seem to increase the likelihood that they will try it. And it doesn't mean that they will like it, but at least they will try it. Sometimes last week he wanted a dragon fruit and it was like $6 per dragon fruit at the store. And I was like, whoa, that is so expensive. I didn't want to do it. But at the same time, I wanted to encourage my son to just try things and to experiment and to further that habit. But that's then getting them involved in the shopping, then the cooking and preparation of it does seem like it helps break down the barrier a bit. But
we made smash burgers and he helped with that. And he said it was the best hamburger he ever had. And also what's helped is to look at TikTok so he can see the whole process, because usually he'll say, yeah, I like that. And then once it's on the table, he's like, I don't know, it's like this. I don't want this. and he'll people say, just don't feed him. And he'll switch between his mom and his dad's house. He will just not eat. Willpower is crazy. He'll be like, fine, I just won't eat. I'll eat your mom's house. So I give in and be like, okay, here's your butter pasta. One last thing, what you just said about having them involved and frozen veggies too. Fresh veggies taste so much better when they're cooked. Pro tip, 12-year-old daughter, she's getting allowance now, $40 a week, which probably is a lot, but I don't really know what the rate is for 12-year-olds. She's folding laundry and other chores, room clean, but also helping with dinner and cutting all the vegetables. And then she eats everything. And it's so nice, right? She's in the kitchen with me and she's prepping and stuff and if you're scared too with your kids with cutting, there's you can get a mesh glove to wear or even a cotton one on your hand, and then you just cut up and talk about the day. And that's really fun too.
It's awesome. Yeah. Good tips. My Christmas list. Mine, sticking to the bike stuff, I'll go quick. SRAM transmission, I want it. I don't have it. I've ridden it. It doesn't feel life-changing like they market it, at least in my opinion. But the fact that you just don't have to deal with derailleur hangers anymore, it would just be nice.
Tell us more about the SRAM transmission and your experience with it.
Yeah, because I demoed it I've ridden a couple bikes with it for, I don't know, probably about a collective 30 miles, mountain bikes with it. And it's you can shift under load. It's electronic. It's wireless. It's got all those good things to it. And it's effectively silent. Just works really darn well. It shifts almost like Shimano in terms of smoothness, but it also shifts way more robustly under power. It shifts better when you do 1200 watts and you try to shift than when you do 100 watts. So the harder you're pedaling, it actually shifts better, which is really cool.
Shift great for me.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then the other side of it too, though, is it doesn't use a derailleur hanger. Instead, it mounts on either side of your axle effectively, and it uses the axle for the strong structure that it's mounting to, which is brilliant because we don't have tiny little quick releases anymore. We have these super thick axles that are really tough, and we might as well use that for the structure. Because I've gone many times where I'm like, I have not fallen over on my bike. Nothing's happened, I swear. Nothing has happened. Yeah. Yet for some reason, my bike isn't shifting right. And I think, okay, I guess I'll switch the derailleur hanger, even though nothing's happened. And lo and behold, once I change it, it shifts well. So I'd like that, but man, it's expensive. The other thing that's even more expensive is RockShox Flight Attendant, and I think it's coming out in the spring, I think. We've seen it all over Pro XC Racers bikes. I've heard from people that have ridden it that it is absolute game changer. It's incredible. So I really want to do that, but it's effectively it adjusts all the suspension tuning for you live, and it's all wireless, and you never have to lock out, and it's incredible.
Oh my God. It's great. That must feel... So at a different weight or something, does it also optimize that live?
Oh, it's brilliant. There's a lot of levels that I'm sure we're going to learn about it. I don't know all of them, but I forgot that they said something like it's for a World Cup course. Oh, I'm probably going to butcher this. It was an alarming amount of times that it made an adjustment to the suspension damping and valving I want to say that it was more than once a second at a World Cup for one of the, when you actually added it all up, if you were to like spread it out across the race, it's like so active at constantly adjusting things.
How much, was the weight increase?
Yeah, I think that it's, how much? So it, nothing's, it hasn't been launched yet, but what it sounds like is there's a weight increase of about 250 grams, but I might be wrong, but 250 grams, you're talking like half a pound. So
the watts that you lose for like the suspension is way more for the speed.
And the cool thing is that it uses your power meter. Biking. It uses your power meter to adjust all of this. What? So it's like taking accelerometer data, movement with your suspension, how you're moving through the stroke. And then it's also taking in data from your power meter and your bike when it's shifting and what gear it's in to be able to understand the right suspension adjustments. It's brilliant.
That must be the, there's like a lot of people don't know this, but your power meter has like, most power meters, not the cork. I don't know, maybe just cork. This wouldn't be probably a cork one, but it has, or it would be a cork.
It is a cork one. Yep. Yeah, cork, all same family.
They they have the ability to do this like scientific mode where it just really sends out extremely fast data. And something like this couldn't do like a sample every quarter second or every second. Yeah, I think it would feel too weird. So when Trainer Road hooks it up, maybe there's like, you know, a little bit of lag, and you've probably seen that in other apps too, but it takes more battery power, but that's what that would need. And that's pretty cool.
And that's why I think like Nino Schurter, Kate Courtney, all these athletes, we've seen them on the new power meter. It's not just they're trying to make a new power meter that's better in one way or another. It's because it's sensing different things that are not currently sensed, and it's sending them at a rate, like Nate said, that's higher. It's pretty cool.
Wow.
So I can't wait till that comes out. And then the last thing is a Specialized Globe Hall LT. It's their e-cargo bike. You can put like a whole protective thing on the back and like seats for your kids. I demoed one from a local shop for 2 weeks. It was incredible. And I'm honestly considering going from two cars to one car and having that. Because for our family, like everything falls within like a 4 mile circle anyway. It's pretty easy to do. We have bike paths too that connect most things around us. So I don't know. It's amazing. It's super fun. What's that?
It's like you're Dutch.
Yeah, it's like we're Dutch. Yeah, exactly. It is incredible. Super fun. Not real product list. I want better shifters from SRAM. I want ones that like actually work and aren't gigantic and hanging down from your handlebars so they break your frame when you have a tip over. Why in the world don't we have tiny little buttons on our handlebars? Like, how can we not do this? We can
they could be really
put people
small,
on
right?
the moon.
Well, yes, can you imagine though when you're like sprinting, bars. Like cross-eyed, like trying to find like a tiny itty bitty little button?
I think you could make them work. You just make them tight to the bar, like a collar around the bar. You know what I mean? Instead of like a thing that's hanging, dangling down.
Jonathan, what
and
you
I'd figure it out.
Exists. Maybe. It spins on the grip handlebar shift. Next to the grip.
Yeah. That's true. I could do grip shift. Yeah. But effectively like that. Like it's just, we need better. And then also a lighter, like electronic rear or dropper post would be great. I love the Reverb one because I like being able to swap it out when I don't need it. But it's like a metric ton. A really good all black 2-in-1 skin suit. This is on the imaginary list because it doesn't exist right now. Like no one makes them. You can
what do, you mean by
do custom kits and it's like $400 or $500. It's like a jersey that's sewn to the bibs and there's no bib straps. So
oh, like a road
it's
suit.
Like what you have. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, kind exactly. Okay. I call them 2-in-1s because the road suit part, like it might just seem like a skin suit, like a normal one. But where it's almost separate from, but it's still connected in the back. If somebody knows of one that's all black, please let me know. Cause I would love to race in that. I wish that Velocio or Rafa made one, but they don't. And then a set of really good rollers, meaning like Tax just released that cool new Neo, trainer. I want like all that sort of tech, but in a really good set of rollers. And it's probably like me and two other people in the entire world. So I don't blame anybody for not doing that, but that's what I personally want. So, okay. We've got a bunch
go
ahead.
I got one more imaginary one. What I want is like a training system that like monitors your fatigue and then gives you a warning before you go too far into like that you might like dig yourself in a hole. So it's called like a yellow day. And then if you keep going, it gives you like a red day. And then if this system then adapted your workouts to understand that these yellow days happen and would like preemptively adjust your training so that you don't get off track. And the part is that yellow day, you'll be able to do it, right? Like you'll be able to do the workout on that yellow day. You'll be able to do a big day, but it's going to have an impact in the future. And then if you go yellow, then red, it could have a big impact in some way that would like, maybe a system that like we'll call it workout levels V2, took all the work that you did outside and fed it in
theoretical. Yeah, theoretical.
To this red light, green light product, which we have, by the way, we need a marketing name for that. Where are we on that? Like, let's crowdsource this. Where are you? Let's go to that in a second. So anyways, I just got a message on this. I'm going to see it after this. If that goes right, I'm going to have certain people on the forum start using it like tomorrow. Well, it's already going to be live to my people. And then if that works, we're going to go early access for people. And there's so many cases and stuff that we're going to have to understand. But anyways, with my stuff, looking back and like the history, it's really cool to see like a yellow day and then look me like end a workout early and be like totally cooked. Like, you know, like it correlates with that, which is really cool. And yeah, the design is done and it's awesome. We need a marketing name. So I think fatigue management, no, I forget what we called it.
Oh gosh, Nate. Yeah, you're putting me on the spot. I can't think of it right now. We came up with a good name, but I bet somebody else could come up with some good names for it too.
Fatigue signal.
The idea too. the idea is that it doesn't, you know, it's a warning and like a notice rather than like, and then you can adapt based on that. But the hard part for some people is like you're going to be able to do a workout that day most of the time. Some of the red days you won't be able to. You know, it's just like someone going, "You sure you want to work out today? Might impact next week." And you're like, "I got this," and you might not got this. So like we're trying to get it out ASAP. But you know, holidays and stuff are going to be tough, but going to be amazing.
Fatigue monitoring. Yeah,
fatigue monitor.
Yeah, that's what we. That's one adaptive of the training one of the ideas with fatigue we came monitor. Up with. Exactly right. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. I looked back at my career and there were many times and it would have saved me. And I'm not like tooting my own horn here for kicks or anything, but I feel like I'm quite attuned to what I can handle and what I can't handle. And I still make mistakes. Like I've been doing this for a long time and I still make mistakes. And this system would have saved me quite a few times from putting myself into a hole. And looking back at my training history, Nate, I didn't find any issues with it looking back over the time course of 2 years. But again, like you said, there's lots of edge cases we need to discover. So
I love when it was a yellow day and I just naturally took it off. I was like, yes,
you knew it.
And then what the next step is we think this might be a way to help subscribe volume for like plan builder of running it through like a simulation with red light, green light or fatigue monitor. And then see what is the right amount that you're not going to get into these holes. And plus like add these other options. And I guess I'll spoil this too. We're adding the ability that on Plan Builder to change not just a workout, but change it to a group ride or a solo ride so that, you know, every Saturday you do a group ride that can go on and it'll be part of your plan. And once you do that ride, workouts level V2, we're not going to show it to you yet. There's still some tweaking, but the backend system uses it to understand that ride. It's more than just TSS. It's using all the workout levels and where you're at to understand how much that ride really stressed you to then, you know, either adapt the next day or tell you you're good to go and give you different like a caution or like maybe a danger. You know, you want to slow down here. Slow down. That's really cool. And I forgot what I was going to say. Oh yeah. So the group ride thing too, you can have every Saturday be a group ride, but then also have the ability to switch it back to a trainer road ride. So, you know, a group ride gets canceled. You're like, boop, I'm going to switch it to a trainer ride. And you get your regular workout that you would have had. Or whatever the workout adaptive training thinks you need that day, very easily to go back and forth. And that's a very common question, and I think it's going to be a little nice feature added to it.
Yep, absolutely. Lots of new stuff coming. So go to trainerroad.com and sign up if you haven't yet. That's exciting times. All that for just $19 a month. Darn good deal. If you sign up annually, it's even cheaper. So it's a really good deal. Darn good deal.
$19.
That's right. Thanks, Nate. Sam says, hi, team. I'm hoping you might be able to help with the terrible case of out of the saddle wobbly hips, which I've noticed even more on the trainer. I'm a road cyclist, and I've recently noticed that if I'm out of the saddle, not putting down massive amounts of effort, my hips seem to flip-flop up and down. Imagine a line between hip bones at the back going vertically up and down on each side, like a seesaw, so like this, and during the pedal stroke. Sam says, it does not look slick. I've tried positioning, tried to activate my core, but not entirely sure what I should be activating. Abs, obliques, lats. I do regular core training, so I'm unsure if weakness is the problem. And I've also tried various amounts of bike rocking from pulling with the lats, but still seem to have a degree of wobbling. My flexibility is pretty good, and I ride a fairly aggressive position. I feel like there's a bit of technique I'm doing wrong, but I can't figure out what it is. Any wisdom you can impart would be very much appreciated. So even though in this case, Ivy, Sam said that like strength might not be the issue, it's still like, because they do some training, I guess somebody listening to this, let's just assume that Sam's already doing this, but somebody listening to this that has this similar problem, strength is very commonly an issue with this sort of thing, some sort of deficiency, right? What sort of recommend or exercises would you recommend?
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of riders that I know do a lot of core still are some of the poorest form riders when out of the saddle, because so much of the core things that they do are so just very linear, very forward. And when we're out of the saddle, uh-huh. we're using so much more than just this like forward strength. And so you can do, you know, 1,000 crunches a day. And that doesn't mean that you're going to have core stability that's going to help you when you're out of the saddle and looking for that fluid motion, mm-hmm. that strengthening things like your transverse abdominis does and your obliques. So those transverse abdominis, it's the really deep core muscle that stabilizes both your spine and your pelvis. And you can train that or strengthen that by doing something like planks and with your obliques, the side planks. But I don't like these anymore because I find that it's really easy to have bad form mm-hmm. and kind of cheat when you're fatigued to like let your hips drop like in both positions. So anyways, to train your transverse abdominis, you can do a dead bug lying on your back. You can Google this. Sorry, I shouldn't try to describe
it. We'll put it on screen too while you're saying it. We'll put it on screen for people.
Mm-hmm. And a hollow body hold. There's not twisting in here, but because of the stability nature of it, that's what will help you when you're out of the saddle. But the oblique strengthening is something that's not a forward motion that involves stability also. So like a Russian twist or wood choppers are, that's like the beginner version and the advanced version. Wood choppers are super tough. And this is really crucial in your rotational stability that will really help you get out of the saddle. And you can try transverse abdominis activators before you ride to see if it helps you get out of the saddle, just like by sitting or standing with good posture and taking a deep breath and holding it through your nose. And then as you exhale, imagine pulling your belly button inward towards your spine as if you're trying to make your waistline smaller, and then hold this contraction for 10 or 15 seconds while continuing to breathe normally. And that'll help activate those muscles, and then release and repeat like 10 or 15 times. And you can tell that this area is a weakness of yours if just doing these activators feel taxing. If it feels like doing a core exercise and it feels difficult, it means that your transverse abdominis is probably really weak, and in which case you should do some more exercises to try to strengthen it specifically.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Other exercise options too, break dancers. I'll put those on the screen so people can see it, but make sure you're touching your toe.
Play Dance yeah. Revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Plank hip dips is another way that you can work on this. Like instead of like Ivy said, like you can cheat with planks and just kind of let your hips drop if you want, but plank hip dips are really good for that. It's like one of my favorite ones. Windshield wipers are also another one that can be really good for this sort of thing too. All the sort of rotational things that you're doing. But Nate, have you, we've talked about pedaling out of the saddle and feeling unstable. You've talked about this a ton before. Did you find anything that helped you feel more stable on the bike? Any sort of like technique cues or anything?
I want to challenge the whole premise that it's a bad thing that the mm-hmm. hips rock. I was mm-hmm. just watching videos of Contador while you said this, I'm like, doesn't Connor he's got like a dog wagging his tail?
Yeah,
dancing one of the salsa. Greatest climbers of all time, like, you know, dope and stuff too, but or tainted clenbuterol beef, allegedly. I don't know.
Good cover, Nate.
It's obviously not enough to make it so that he can't win climbs. And some of the things to think about too is that if you are taller, this is going to be exaggerated. And if you have longer cranks, this is going to be exaggerated. And mm-hmm. if you both of you have seen me walk, but I'm tall and I have long legs. And when you have a longer stride, your hip automatically has to dip. So when I walk, like my hips like go da 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 because I take long strides. And it's just like physically impossible to get your leg out without dropping your hip. And now when you're mm-hmm. up above and you're doing this, you're probably in a position that feels... it's not going to be locked out, but it feels pretty comfortable. You're not going to be really like deep into your squat when you're doing it. And the only way to keep your hips level is going to be able to like, you're going to have to be deeper into your squat and be maintaining that and kind of like shifting your momentum each side. And I definitely do that on mountain biking when it's a really steep, mm-hmm. like if it's, mm-hmm. if it's mountain biking and it's a steep thing, you can't do the shift because you'll just lose contraction. And I've seen you do it too, John, where you're like really deep into your squat and you're doing all the things that you should, pulling back the handlebars, really dig that rear wheel in. And
It's like your chest is toward the bars, your chin's toward the bars, sort of a thing in those situations. And like a sprint is different than just getting out of the saddle too, right? Like to your point,
Nate, totally different.
Yeah. the main thing that I think of with this is that you will have hip movement, like Nate said, and it's okay, and don't feel like you need to cut it out. If you do feel unstable, that's a different thing. And feeling unstable, a lot of the time, like Nate said, when you're coming up, a lot of people don't bend their knees a whole lot when they're standing out of the saddle, and they kind of keep their legs a bit more straight. And as a result, they get a lot of upper body movement. But if your shoulders aren't moving, all that movement's going to get stuck in your hips, and it's not going to be able to transfer upward through your body. If you're on the trainer, your bars probably aren't moving a whole lot, right? They aren't turning, and then the bike isn't moving side to side. So probably what's happening is that all the movement is getting stuck in your hips. It's not just leaning your bike to the side as well either. You'll notice, like, look at Contador when he's riding. His bars are like turning when he's out of the saddle. And it's probably not the most effective weight in terms of like, he's probably losing watts by like, you know, turning his handlebars while he does that going up the mountain. But that's why you'll see riders not wag quite as much, is because they're moving the wag into the bike, or they're moving the wag up and spreading it out throughout their body. But in this case, something's got to give. Like, you know, you're pedaling, your hips are definitely going to be moving because your legs are moving a whole lot. So it just means that at some point in your system, Sam, you've hit a block and it's just stuck into your hips. At least that's what from what you're saying here. And it can probably be transferred through more movement through the bike or through more movement through your body.
Sam is not saying that he feels unstable. He's just saying it doesn't look good.
Like, yeah. I don't look good when I get out of the saddle either.
You do. It's just me, though.
I don't care.
It's crazy. No, John, you look freaking pro in all the things you do, and it's annoying. just say you look like Condor. Like, does Chris Froome look good?
No.
You look good? No. Ever.
No, he's right. Yeah, like a spider on a bike, but didn't stop him from winning the Tour de France.
There's something too, when you train a ton, and I think it's probably Condor too, is you develop efficiency, and like your body naturally gets into whatever the efficient state is for that part. And maybe your hips are a little bit wider or something. I'm not sure. There's something in your bones that make this happen. And rather than trying to conform to like a certain air quotes look of cyclists, just focus on putting more watts and what feels less gassing. And you could try these things where you squat a little bit and all this stuff and see if it really helps. If you do have a strong core, I love all these core exercises, but maybe it's not the thing. I don't know. It's,
yeah,
I don't really know.
It's not going to hurt.
Do you need to fix it?
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, it is a good reminder that like the things that look good or bad in cycling may not directly correlate to your efficiency, right? Not just like how much power you can create, but how efficient you are on the bike. And so we should, you know, be challenging that.
Yeah, exactly.
Sock height.
Byron sent in some quick questions. Says, hello all to my favorite podcast hosts from rainy Manchester. While watching cyclocross this year, I've noticed a few changes I want to get your opinions on. Number one, whereas shoes with laces seemed to be somewhat common 5 years ago, I haven't seen a single pro using them in the World Cups this year. Why? Honestly, they were in vogue and they were kind of stylish a handful of years ago, and they're not as in vogue anymore. It's kind of like a style thing. Laces also can get wet and stretch a little bit, and cyclocross is very wet. It's a pain also to take your shoes off. And
yes,
Bo, is you just either pull it or you just get it done and your shoes come right off. It's handy.
Imagine too, in cyclocross, you get laces wet and they're extremely hard to undo, and you have an issue with your cleat, right? How are you gonna, like, they're gonna have to cut it off or something, and it just makes more sense to pull that boa. I know there's maybe a weight issue too, but it's probably so little.
Yeah. Number two, looking at older race footage, even when following advice from my first cyclocross clinic in 2012, people used to ride in the drops all the time. Now, nobody seems to ride in the drops unless they're sprinting or it is a fast section of the course like the start finish. Why is this? What do you think, Ivy? You're the cyclocross.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking how much I hate riding in the drops and cross unless it's like a very rare sprint finish. And I think it's one of those kind of like old school mentalities that I can't really explain, that's almost dogmatic, like this is how we do this. And I'm thinking of like a clinic that I did once a really long time ago, and this coach was just their romantic partner was there doing the clinic and just yelling at her, like right in the drop, like down this super sketchy descent, and was just, you know, demanding she ride in the drops on the super sketchy descent. And I remember she was like, why? And the answer was just because it's what we do. And that really like stuck with me for a long time. I was like, why? We don't need to. If you feel stable on the hoods and you have, I feel like I have better brake control up higher on the hoods when I'm in like a really tricky technical section or on a descent. It's so hard for me to feather the brakes and like moderate it when I'm in the drops. and then moving back and forth. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. Like, it's fine. And maybe, maybe advancements in braking brakes have something to do with that.
For sure.
When you're on
disc
old
brakes, like huge, right?
Yeah. When you're on rim brakes, maybe you do need more braking power on a tricky descent. And that's maybe why you should be in the drops or something, or it's harder to moderate or feather the brakes on rim brakes when you are up on the top of the hoods, but we don't need to do that anymore. Disc brakes are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stack height has also gone down on a lot of bikes as well. So where you're putting your hands, like if you were to put them in the drops, it's really, really low. Whereas before, head tubes used to be a lot taller on bikes, and now they're a lot squattier in a lot of cases. So because of that, like, yeah, you're already low enough. You have way more control on modern hoods too. They're way better designed. Like, you can hold on to them and get a lot of leverage on your bike. Yeah, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Number three.
This reminds me of Pete when he set up his crit bike that his, like, the tops would be like the bar, like the drops. And because he knows he's going to be in there all the time. So instead of having to switch between, or like everything you said is the downfalls of being in the drops in cyclocross, you don't have the disc brake issue. It just makes sense to set it up where you're going to be the whole time aerodynamically. And even like, man, I'm trying to think of like, do you ever see Vanderpool like in the drops?
Hardly ever. Sprint finishes across like long start straights, but typically he's always got his hands on the hoods. So
I'm looking at like pictures of him right now, and I don't see a single one of him in it. And just because it's probably the position is set up for that. And he has no spacers, and I think he's got like a, you know, this negative stem, and it makes sense.
Yeah. His next one, I'm seeing that what seems like most athletes consuming gels on the starting line, and it didn't used to be this way. Will a gel really help in such short races? Yeah.
I think we know more about nutrition than we did even 5 years ago, like 10 years ago and beyond.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Huge change. Maybe, right.
You know, I remember when I started maybe like 2007, I remember like the goo being like consume 20 minutes before your race. I think maybe correct me if I'm wrong, Ivy, but is the cyclocross have more tradition kind of like, you know, how like triathlon is like cutting edge. And they'll try everything. Mm-hmm. And then she's rolling her eyes.
Yes, I'm sorry. And
as you go like, as you go
You did that deeper, out loud, Ivy.
Sorry.
Into like the purest, air quotes, cyclist, there's more tradition and less science.
Guys, it's so annoying. Yeah. There's science later. Like, and I just can't tell you how many times I've heard, just because it's just what we do. Like, no, it's so annoying. Cyclocross specifically has such dogmatic is the best word that I can think of it. Like, this is what we do. We've always done it this way, so it must be good. And these are what Europros did back then. And so this is what, you know, I just, I'm not down with
champions
it.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like yeah. 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 And I mean, it literally takes a matter of seconds before you can start to absorb sugar into your bloodstream from a gel. But in terms of when it can be used and everything else, yeah, like a lot of then modern studies have shown that within a time course of 15 minutes, you can expect to receive benefit in terms of performance from that sort of thing. I mean, even just taking in and swishing with a sugary drink, but not even swallowing it has shown performance improvements. So, there are multiple layers as to why athletes are taking them on the start line. And then number four, finally, I've seen athletes using Trainer Road to warm up, including Lucinda Brand. Why don't you ever talk about the athletes you sponsor on the podcast? It's because we don't sponsor any athletes.
It's really just that great that pros don't use it too.
The best is when they're sponsored by a competitor and they still use us.
And people send us pictures from the race, like expand, and they're zooming in on the
I mean, Matthew Vanderpool too. Like, we got a lot of pictures of him warming up. For World Champs. Trainer Road. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So
you don't pay anything to any of that.
We just got reached out to by another Leica, by a very fast Euro gravel racer that wants us to sponsor him and stuff. And we love you, but we don't sponsor athletes. So
the reason too is that I don't see the return. We don't have this big marketing team. So let's say we did pay, how much would Vanderpool want? Like hundreds of thousands, right?
Yeah, and then hundreds and
how
hundreds
are we gonna, what you got to do is you have to implement that. Right. Like, so you have to have photo shoots and this and like put it all in these places and commercials and all that, which costs even more money. And that's, it's a big team doing that. And that makes sense for, you know, the top brands. But for us, and then when you sponsor some of the lower athletes, you know, they say, well, I'll post you on my Instagram 8 times, you know, in a month. And it's just not the reach again with that. And we've tried it so many times through different different networks and stuff. And yeah, it's
tough. It makes sense if you have like a huge marketing budget and you need to like use that budget to be able to get like exposure. So you spread it out and you have some sort of strategic plan with specific athletes or something else, but we don't have investors. So we're a bootstrapped company. So the money that we make, we spend on our employees to make great features. And that's really how we work as a company. So
we'd really have to be sponsored by Trader Joe's with big bucks if we wanted to sponsor athletes. Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah, we should be the one sponsor.
Yeah. For sure. But Lucinda, for what it's worth, Lucinda has reached out to us and messaged us before, and Ivy and I both had like a fangirl moment where we were like, it was pretty darn cool to have Lucinda reaching out. So we're huge fans of all these athletes that we see using Trainer Road that are pros and stuff. It's just great. We are stoked that you find it helpful. So Chase's question says, it's often suggested on the podcast that body position counts for more significant aero gains than equipment. And while I'm inside on the trainer preparing my base fitness,
not just suggested by the podcast, suggested by like the wind tunnel. By like science, right? Yeah. We're not just making this up. Exactly. We're not making it up. Sorry.
Yeah. Chase says, while I'm inside on the trainer preparing my base fitness, what specific changes can I work on with my body position to be more aerodynamic once the race season starts? Chase then says, elbows at 90 degrees, shoulders shrugged, head up, etc. And then says, P.S. I'm a retool bike fitter and would appreciate sharing these recommendations with my competitive clients. First of all, I did my first retool bike fit this year. We have, Nate, by the way, like locally, we have like a really good retool bike fit center now. It's awesome. At Sierra Bike Supply.
What does that mean? What does super retool cool. mean? What is that?
It's like it's a whole fit system. So, and the cool part about it is it kind of gives you like anchor points and it tells you like from here to here, this range is typically what we've found across many hundreds of thousands of fits with competitive athletes. And this is what we found. So it's cool because it gives you like a reference point instead of some guy with a plumb bob going like, I always put people's knees here. You know, it's actually something that's larger, more data-based. It's really cool. It's a cool experience.
Dots on your body so they can, as you pedal, it can track really where you're sitting. Because sometimes you're like, you know, you're in one position, but when you pedal, you like scooch and you move your butt or something of where you're actually sitting on the saddle. And then it can record that, take like the averages, throw out some outliers, and really understand where you're at.
Cool. It's really cool. So Chase knows his stuff for sure. So he's talking about these aerodynamic, like the different changes he can take. I wanted to look into this because I just wanted to see if there was research published on the aero gains that was not a media outlet going to like test like sponsored products in a wind tunnel and see if they make you faster. I found this really cool study, and I apologize because I'm probably going to butcher this pronunciation here, but it's from Shafarzik and colleagues in 2022. And the study is titled, and we'll link to this down below, Aerodynamic Benefits by Optimizing Cycling Posture. They wanted to quantify the impacts of four different positions and their time savings and within the context of the bike course at Kona at the Ironman World Championships. So that's 180-kilometer, 112-mile bike course. It's like famously windy, but also famously straight with no real reason to slow down except for one turnaround. Anyways, with that in mind, they did some cool stuff. They used 3D scanning of a professional athlete. Nate, it's a tall athlete, 1.96 meters, 6'4", so not quite as tall as you, but still tall athlete. 82 kilograms, 180 pounds, and they tested them in these different postures. I'll go into that in just a sec. They used an iPhone, and they used a LiDAR scanner, and they scanned the athlete, which was pretty interesting. And then they used 3D modeling and a machine learning model to be able to look at this scan and then turn it into a person. And they validated a bunch of this in a lot of different ways, and it all worked to be able to create like a person that they could run through software to then calculate CDA and all the implications that it would have. It was super neat. The software that they used was called Nabla Flow's AeroCloud software. And these are the four, and they tested at 22 miles an hour and yaw angles from 0 to 20. Yaw means 0 degrees, like if you had a perfect headwind, no side wind whatsoever, and then 20 degrees would be on either side. So they tested these different positions. They tested one where you were just up, like super upright, and that was hands on the hoods and you leaning way up. They tested another one where they had their hands in their drops and their arms were slightly bent, but mostly straight, right? But just down to the drops. And then they had the one where, like Nate mentioned earlier, Pete's position, where hands are on the hoods and then your forearms are dropped so that they're parallel with like the top of with the ground, so to speak. So really hunched over, and then your hands are on the hoods, but your arms are parallel to the ground. And then the last thing that they did is they tested a time trial position that this athlete had. And there are some super interesting things that we're going to get from this. And then we'll bring it back from this. We'll bring it back into practical things you can do. But basically, here's the breakdown. So yes, the two most aerodynamic positions, of course, the time trial position was the most aerodynamic. And then they also had the position where they had their hands on the hoods and the forearms down low. That was also pretty darn aerodynamic. And yes, being in the drops was slightly more aerodynamic than being your straight up on your bike as well. That was the worst position. But here's the interesting stuff. So not all positions were affected the same depending on yaw angle. And this is really neat. So basically, if you're dealing with crosswinds, one position that may seem like it would be more aerodynamic in some cases was less aerodynamic than you would think. Or the even more interesting is that you got faster in the TT position when instead of being at perfectly 0 degrees yaw, you actually had some wind coming from the side. That's interesting, right? Like you'd always think that crosswinds would make you faster or make you slower. But in some cases, yeah. Can you explain that, Nate? What do you mean by the sail?
Yeah, that's when you... when you're sailing, you need the wind on the side, and then you're I don't know much about it. Yeah, I forget what it's called. Yeah. Tacking. Your sail hits the wind, and then you go forward more.
Yeah, exactly. It aids in propulsion, right? That wind coming from the side, which is pretty darn interesting. So they measured a CDA value, which is your coefficient of drag area. So that's how people measure drag for aerodynamics. They measured 0.42 for the athlete that was super upright. Remember, this is a really tall athlete too, so that's why it's such a big number. 0.42 with their hands on the drops, they dropped to 0.39. And then in that arrow peak position with her arms parallel to the ground, 0.281, and the TT position, 0.246. I'm going to compare these really quick. So if you were to adopt this position that we're putting on screen now, where you're holding onto the hoods, but your arms are parallel to the ground, that position compared to sitting upright, it's 33% less drag. Ew. If you compare it to being in the drops, it's 28% less drag.
Well, that's tough because it's always the mount is at different speeds too, about how much drag there is, since drag is exponential.
Yeah, this is 22 miles an hour, and this is at 0 degrees yaw. So those are the stipulations. Yep. And then if you look at the time trial position being upright, that was 42% faster. Time trial position versus the drops, 37% faster. And time trial position versus that peak position is 13% faster.
Percent less drag?
Less drag. Forgive me. Less drag. Yeah. I should clarify. Because less drag doesn't equivalent.
42% faster. That's crazy.
Yeah. 2-hour bike split time at Kona. Here we come. So I'll put some charts that you can see up on screen that are pretty interesting from this study. And thank you for making this study available. It's just really darn cool. But you can see that, like, in some cases, actually, and specifically if we look at the time trial position, you get faster the more yaw that you get. All the way up to 20. There's like an inflection point where it starts to go back up and you get more drag once you get up to 20 degrees yaw. But that's pretty crazy that it actually ends up making you faster. Whereas if you're in the upright position, you lose that sailing effect and you get, it just gets slower and slower the more yaw you experience.
I remember when we saw this first, I think it was maybe Zip many years ago, where they had it where this disc wheel, this new profile, I think it had to go with rider rims too. It's been so long, I forget. But they had data of like, there's negative drag here. What, like, why is there negative drag? And
it's wild.
This, you know, it's a whole marketing thing around it too, of like, we did it again, blah, blah, blah. But now it's common for disc reels to have that negative drag at certain angles. And for the CDA, the rule of thumb, just rule of thumb, is for every hundredth is about a watt. So the difference between the straight arms, the hoods, and the drops on this one is only 3 watts. But then the straight arms, hands, and drops down to the drop body, hands, and hoods, that's like 11 watts. And then the time trial bars from the beginning to the end, that's about, 38 watts? 28 watts. No, 20? Yeah, 18 watts. That doesn't seem like enough, though. I think it'd be more than that.
It might be.
If you're really, like, sitting up straight. I'm surprised, actually.
The thing about this that's really interesting, though, is this speaks to why TT positions, like aero bikes, can make you... It's not the bike. It's the position that you have. Can make you so much faster. Because if you look at it in a typical circumstance, you are not riding at 0 degrees yaw. Like that's not normal. If you look at the distribution of that, this is distribution on the Kona course. They simulated it with like realistic weather conditions. And it's a bit more extreme where they saw wind even at like 22 miles an hour. They saw situations where yaw far exceeded 20 degrees. And it was just like a direct crosswind where somebody was pushing you over effectively is what it would feel like. And for triathletes, you know how sketchy that feels when you're coming down from Javi and how strong that wind can be when you're doing that. But in most cases, the majority of your time is going to be spent somewhere around 10 to 15 degrees, or maybe even more safely said, 5 to 15 degrees. So that's where these aerodynamic positions like start to have increasing benefit for you when you're in a TT position or where your arms are parallel to the ground. Those positions start to deliver even more benefit once you get into crosswind scenarios. And considering that you spend the majority of your time in those scenarios, that's why they can just make you so much faster, especially something like a long course at Kona. In the end, what they saw is that if you're in an upright position versus in a full TT position, you save around 20% in terms of time, or you cut your drag in half roughly if you average it out across all the spectrum of yaw. I'll show you that chart on screen. That equaled about a 20% time savings, which is roughly 60 minutes at Kona, and an hour that you could save off just being upright versus being in that TT position, which is huge on a day that's so particularly hard like that. And the reason that I'm going through this study is because I'd rather like not sell you like, yeah, do this. This feels really good and fast. But rather, data backs up this position that is achievable for everybody without a TT bike, of just holding onto the hoods and getting so that your arms, your forearms get parallel to the ground. And that's a position that when you do that, a couple things happen. It's not just that your arms, your forearms aren't catching wind. To get your elbows that low so that they're parallel, it really forces you to drop your torso. It forces you to round out your shoulders. It forces you to do a lot of things that make you more aerodynamic. So yeah, I mean, you already knew the answer here before you asked it, Chase. Rounding out your shoulders, like shrugging them, you know, keeping your head low instead of looking upright, but rather keeping your head in a position where you might be looking forward, but keeping your head kind of like turtled in your shoulders. And then inching your way down into that position so that you can hold your hoods and then just get your forearms more and more parallel to the ground. And there's no better time to do that when you're on the trainer, because you can inch your way into things and you can say, cool, I've got 6 intervals today. On the first interval, I'm going to do this change. On the second interval, I'm going to do this change. And you can just work your way in, and it makes your workouts go by like crazy fast. But yeah, I mean, that's what I would say.
I wonder too if Chase, we did one on the, like a road athlete, but is this Chase a triathlete maybe? I don't know.
Yeah. That's a good point, right, Nate? Yeah.
Yeah. And when the annoying part about aerodynamics is when we went to the velodrome and we did a testing with power meter and we're on the velodrome to get our CDA and we tried different positions. You know, there's like, how spaced should your elbows be? What should be the angle of your hands? And it's not cut and dry for everybody. It's not like John's, yeah. John might be, John, were you flat or up? I forget.
You're flat. Up a bit. Wait, no. And we couldn't bring my arms up because my bike's limitations that I had at that time.
Oh yeah.
Would have loved to try that.
Yeah. It's not there. So I would, I mean, honestly too, comfort is huge, because if you get out, even if you just get out for a little bit, you break some of the laminar flow yeah. breaks, and then it takes a while to get back into it. It's not like when you get back in the aero, it's immediately that aerodynamic, like that CDA, it like has to like settle in on you. And if you keep getting back and forth, you could even be slower. That's tough.
Yeah. Good example of that is like, if you have like a thing and your plan is to sight every 10 or 15 seconds, and you tucking your head down, if you have like a long tail on your helmet or something like that, you tucking your head like into an aero position, then looking back up and repeating that over and over, it might be just as well that you just stay in a spot that's a bit more comfortable and you can see the whole time. Because like Nate said, every time you do that, it might take half that time just to reestablish laminar flow anyway. And meanwhile, you're making yourself uncomfortable. So yeah, you have to inch your way into it, right, Nate? Regardless of whatever changes you do, you just have to like incrementally spend more time there. So
this is the great time to do it in the base season on the trainer, be able to adapt to it.
It's perfect for it. I was riding this weekend with Chelsea Sodaro, Ironman world champion. And she's awesome. And yes, good point. Thanks for calling me out for that, Nate. But we were talking about Kona and about Ironman and all this stuff and optimizing positions and these pro athletes that you see that look super aerodynamic and everything else. It's not natural. A lot of these athletes consciously are doing exactly what you're doing right now, about thinking about every interval, spending a little bit more time or making another little subtle tweak and working their way into it. You know, it takes a lot of work for these, even at the tip top of the spear, a lot of work to to get efficient like this. So yeah, little by little, just work your way into it. Okay, Jennifer's question says, I'm hoping to win the lottery for Unbound 100 and I've started doing training, but I seem to have a problem. On my longer training rides, I'm having trouble staying hydrated enough without having to pee every hour. Generally, I'm drinking one bottle of scratch per hour on these rides lasting 2 to 3 hours, plus drinking 16 ounces of plain water about 2 hours before my ride. I'm worried that there won't be enough bathroom stops or any trees to hide behind along the Unbound course. So is there something I can change to remedy this problem, i.e. more salt intake, different electrolyte mix, etc.? Have you ever had to cope with a bathroom break in the middle of an endurance ride? Love the podcast, by the way. You guys are my favorite thing to listen to on Zone 2 workouts. So I'll put
pee
like
while
some...
pedaling.
I'm just thinking that. You don't have to do that.
Like a racehorse. Full gallop.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, if you're racing, why not? I'm going to put on screen so people can see the amount of sodium that's within and potassium. Otherwise, they're quite similar between scratch and then Precision Hydration's stuff. This isn't me promoting Precision Hydration. It's just they have a really easy to understand like breakdown of the sodium amounts and the electrolyte amounts within their products. So it just makes it really easy. Scratch has 380 milligrams of sodium and 38 milligrams of potassium. Meanwhile, the least like dense product that Precision Fuel and Hydration makes is called their PH500. And that just has 500 milligrams of sodium. So significantly more than 380. It also has, all of these ones have 250 milligrams of potassium, which is an important electrolyte in your body as well. Not as crucial as sodium though. But then if you look at that, then they have a 1000 milligram one and a 1500 milligram one. So relatively speaking, Scratch is pretty light. So, I mean, maybe that's the case, right? Ivy, it's just like under, she's just not getting enough sodium.
Yeah, I think like a gram and a half of table salt, just regular table salt, is I think 600 milligrams of sodium.
Yes, right around there.
Yeah.
Around like, 700, 800. Yep.
Yeah, most athletes that we know, you know, sweat rate is you're losing about 500 milligrams-ish.
Oh, at
Jennifer,
least.
You yeah. Yeah. Jennifer should do, get one of the affordable Gatorade sweat tests to figure out how much sodium you're actually losing and how much you need. And then from there, I would want Jennifer to try to like change up the hydration strategy to get more sodium and less just fluid mass to see if that helps you have to go to the bathroom less. But other things to consider, bladder irritants like caffeine. Are you timing your workout so you are they really early in the morning and you're slamming, you know, two big cups of coffee so that you can do your workout and then trying to do your workout and drinking, you know, could that contribute to it? Or weak pelvic floor muscles may be causing you to urinate a lot. When your pelvic floor muscles are weak, you're not effectively emptying your bladder every time you urinate. So it may make you feel like or actually need to go to the bathroom shortly after you just did. And there are plenty of exercises you can do to strengthen your pelvic floor. I don't think it's a pelvic floor thing. It might be, but I think it's just a sodium thing.
Mm-hmm. I just looked on the website, Nate, and those Gatorade patches are half off. I know that's not evergreen because you might be listening to this and maybe they aren't half off, but if you're listening to this now, look up Gatorade GX sweat patch and they're half off. So you can buy five of them for $37 here in the US.
I'm gonna get some.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I've never, Nate, I don't know, but I can't remember your sodium loss rate. I feel like was quite high. I know your fluid rate was high, but I've never heard of a person being under, that's been tested. I've never heard of them being less than 500. Around 500, yes, but less than 500, I haven't heard of. So it's kind of like an alarm bell for me, you know?
Yeah, test it out. Also, Jennifer, you can drink less. Like if you start to pee every hour, drink less. Good time to have not having your food in your bottles, if you don't have that dialed, especially for this, having food separate from that. So you can separate the two because it's the variables you're going to have, even though you lock it in, for Unbound could be hot, could be cold. Like you don't know unless did they change it where it's always a hot or cold. But I remember, I don't know when I was doing it, that it was variable, like too annoying amount variable of what it could be in Kansas. Maybe the whole same day, right? Could be blazing hot, then thunderstorms. So you're drinking water and you're raising your plasma volume and your body wants to be in this homeostasis, then you're going to pee later. The faster you drink the water, the faster it's going to try to like bring it back down. So if that earlier bottle that you're doing an hour before these rides, plus the plain drinking water, 2 hours before the ride, you're just like slamming it. I don't know if you need to do that to like load up on water, especially if you're peeing right away. I would just skip that, or at least do that, what Ivy said too, with that and electrolytes. Yeah. And then, so everything you guys said too, but then another thing I learned, this is a little bit off topic, but not. Yeah. You ever guys like drink, not you, John, you ever have caffeine, or have you ever drink coffee and like get the jitters afterwards?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I have some people.
It's super common though, right? I feel like I've heard of it a lot. Yeah.
And what it might be actually is loss of electrolytes actually, and not due to the high caffeine content, but then the coffee and caffeine shedding electrolytes. And I've been really lowering my caffeine intake, and it still happened to me, but I compare it with electrolytes. I do the Precision Hydration 1500 because it tastes like grapefruit and I really like it. And it's been really helpful. So that's also very interesting to like solve that. It's really annoying when it happens too. You feel horrible for like a while, and you're kind of like shaking, and you feel weak, and it's no good.
Yeah, like urination is like one of like the main goals is your body's. It's a homeostasis lever, right? Like your body uses that to either dilute your blood or to not dilute your blood as much. That's how it uses that. So I view that 16 ounces that you take of water beforehand, like you're just setting up the scene for your body to get into the spot where it's gonna pee a lot. And then after that, then you take in a lot. So it's like getting the signal that's like, hey, I've got a lot of fluid and I'm supposed to get rid of it. So I would get rid of that, like Nate said, for sure, beforehand. Like it's just setting the scene for things to work in that direction.
You could also, Jennifer, I'm sorry, weigh yourself before and after. Take all your bottles in your kit, get on, or take your food out and then weigh yourself. And then at the end, weigh yourself. And you can weigh, you can lose some body weight. You should, because you're gonna lose glycogen too. You don't need to replace like pound for pound. And gosh, I'm blanking on it. I had a whole spreadsheet for this, but you can lose, I think maybe up 3-5% and be okay. And then once you lose more, it's a drop off, it's a cliff, and you don't want to do that. But you can start to play with that and understand what your actual hydration need is, and you can also kind of understand your sweat rate, although it's gonna overly. You're gonna have glycogen and then some like food in your tummy, but it's that probably be a really good way, because you're coming back heavier than you started. Like that would be like, wow, I'm really drinking too much.
Yeah. And Unbound, it's a long day. This past year I've moved to a strategy of separating out my electrolytes. I do take in around 640 milligrams of sodium in each bottle.
Around,
and that's just like Ivy said.
he's just guessing. So he doesn't know.
Listen here. No. It's because 1 gram of table salt gives you roughly 640 milligrams of sodium. The rest is chloride. So, or may I have that backwards? I think it's 400. I think there's more chloride. I could be wrong. But anyways, a fraction of that. So I just put in like a gram of that, and then that's taken care of. But I take in the rest of my electrolytes through salt capsules, the Precision Hydration ones. You can get them in a blister pack. That way they don't get like sweaty and sticky or anything. It's easy. You just like you put the thing in your mouth and like push it with your thumb, and then you've got a little capsule in your mouth, and easy, and it goes that way. Because I've found problems before with when I'm drinking electrolytes, I also get to the point where I pee too much, because and then if I'm just taking in gels, then it makes it really hard for me to do both. So I have all of my sugar, my carbs and glucose and fructose in my bottles, and I drink that. And then I have my sodium mostly separated through those Precision Hydration capsules. They're 250 milligrams each. So that means that you might be popping a lot of them. But when I did like longer races this year, I was popping, you know, 3 to 4 of those things an hour sometimes, and it was really hot, and that's what it felt like my body needed. So, it can be a good way, like separating the two. So then just to take in electrolytes, you don't have to drink a bunch of water, like Nate was pointing out. So, all right, Nate, these next two questions are related, but entirely opposite to each other. And they kind of beg for your perspective as like the person that was like, if you were me, what would you do? So Michael says, hey guys, love the podcast, showing love from Belgium. I have a question regarding Kermesse racing, mostly flat races. I live in Belgium, which is a blessing and a curse. Lots of races, but high-level bike racers. There are no Cats 1 through 5. It's Elite 2. In other words, riders without a contract, which is what I would be racing. That's pretty savage. Ouch. You have like you have a contract or you don't have a contract. That's your entire category system. That's pretty rough. The racing is basically a crit of 100 to 120 kilometers done at speeds of 45 kilometers an hour. That is a long, that's 60 mile crit. That's like, that's pretty intense. So, I'm new to cycling, and with my competitive swimming background, a sprinter doing 50 to 100 meter races, I'm a pretty big rider. My gym lifts are 140 kilograms for my squat, which is 300 pounds, 180 kilograms for my deadlift, which is 400 pounds, 100 kilograms for my bench, which is 220 pounds, and 60 kilograms for my overhead press, which is 130 pounds. I pend low row, that's the hardest thing to say in the world, the same as my bench. I'm still somewhat chubby at 95 kilograms, 210 pounds, and I went down to 80 kilograms at 176 pounds, but my sprint fell off by a ton. So what should I focus on being a heavy rider in terms of strategy and training? My FTP is around 250 to 260, and I have a 6-second 1,800 watt sprint tested at a cycling center where I was weighing 90-ish kilograms and an 850 watt 30-second sprint, which peaked around 1,300 watts. I also did an unloaded max cadence test, which is around 237 RPM. That is speedy. My sprint technique also probably needs some work since I don't shift in my sprint. Lower RPM sprints work better for me, they said, in the cycling center. Sounds like a track cyclist. Mm-hmm. Those are some impressive numbers, though.
The 6-second 1,800-watt sprint, if you're in position, is going to be enough to win a bazillion races, including pro races.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's if it's going fast. Absolutely. But the position, you're not going to be there. With the 250-watt FTP, I mean, you're not going to be in position to be able to do this. And honestly, to have better race results, you probably are going to lose some of your sprint power because having a 300-pound squat form of deadlift and 220-pound bench is not very common, right? Or we'd see the top sprinters kind of have probably this
Most this cyclists can't do that.
If you go back to what are the videos called? The race analysis videos we have? Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch about where Pete's a heavy rider, actually probably the same as you. And I was around maybe like 180, 185 during that. It's all about momentum and like keeping momentum and not hitting the brakes and like coasting back and forth. Because you're so heavy, when you have to accelerate, it's going to feel harder than everyone else. And these are the long races. Those little teeny accelerations are going to be tough. You obviously have a fantastic... 850 watts for 30 seconds
yikes.
With a 1300 watt peak. I mean, dude, that like 30 seconds to go, or actually even 1 minute to go, you 1300 watt pop off the front, or, you know, if it slows down, which this race probably won't slow down because I'm guessing there's like cap one level people in it. Sounds so hard. You got to get that separation. And then if you're doing 850, everyone's looking at each other being like, they can't catch you. 1300 watts is going to be like what they might be able to do in the sprint at the end. And if you can go back to front at all, that'd be amazing too. Ivy, you want to say something?
Here's the thing though. These numbers that were gathered in this test, could Michael do this at the end of a 60 mile race, 100 kilometer race?
No way.
You know?
No way.
Right? Yep. And so Michael is my favorite kind of sprinter to beat. People like to look, I'm serious. People like to like look at a big person, a strong person, someone that has a history in traditional sport or lifting weights and has like really big one rep PRs and just like look like a meatball and look like traditionally strong. And those are the people that can't reproduce those numbers at mile 60 of a race than they can in a controlled trainer setting or even in training, right? Especially at speed in the last 4 or 5K of a race like this. I think if Michael really wants to be a better sprinter and get better results, you need to work on lengthening your sprint. So if you can turn a 5 or 6 second really good effort into a 10 or 12 second one that has less pop and you're focusing less on that short game or, you know, the really short power explosive stuff, understand that, and I'm sure Michael's probably already experienced this, that it's not going to be like a slow, I mean, it does happen every once in a while, but most of the time a sprint finish like this isn't like a slow drag. We're looking at each other and then you get to do a big burst and you're fresh and you get to just for 5 or 6 seconds go as hard as you can. It's not like that in a sprint finish. And so to focus on lengthening your sprint when you are already fatigued and when the speed is already really, really high is something that you have to practice in training and something that will help you get better results.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you're brand new to cycling. You said you're pretty new to cycling and you got the competitive swimmer background. So you're going to have this probably huge aerobic engine that is untapped at the moment and you're going to convert this to cycling. But if you're 95 kilograms, 210 pounds, with a, 250 watt FTP to be 4 watts per kilo, which could be starting to be competitive, like be in the field here, especially with being big in a flat field, that's a 380 watt FTP. Mm-hmm. So that's a long, like a long ways to go. And I could do pretty well with like 360, but not with your sprint power. So if you can combine the two, but you gotta be okay losing some of that sprint power. And what Ivy said is you have to be able to put the power out at the sprint and, you got to have a big aerobic engine for that. And imagine in a race, I don't know how you're going to sit in with 250 watts. Even with that, if these people really are 4 or 5 watts per kilo, it's going to be hard to even draft these people and when they're going fast. Hopefully there's some kind of lower level race you can do. As I'm thinking they're just like thrown with like, Justin Williams or something. Like, I guess not that, so but like,
pro or you're not a pro, basically. It's pretty intense.
4 or 5 watt kilo people who are just going to like be really, really good. But that's, you're going to, use Trainer Road, do your up your FTP. You're going to be able to put out your FTP 250 watts for hours later, which is crazy. Hours. You're going to hold it for like the whole race is going to be your easy pace. And if that's your easy pace, then you're going to be more set up for the sprint.
I mentioning that he's 50 to 100 meter swimmer. That's the background. That's roughly like 20 seconds to roughly a minute, like in terms of efforts that you're doing for 50s to 100s. I don't feel like I would be concerned about losing your sprint ability. Mm-hmm. Like if you focus on building up all of your aerobic conditioning to the point where you are really aerobically efficient at 380 watts, if you do that, I guarantee you with very small amount of work, you'll be able to call upon that what you've trained for years as a swimmer, and you will be able to develop those sort of sprint abilities. And man, like one of the hardest things about racing Nate in a criterium is that 1 minute power that Nate has that's very good. And if I'm racing Nate, it's always really tricky because I'm like, well, if I go too early and he just latches on, I know that he has like a minute in him that's really, really hard. And that I can't compete with. If you can become that sort of athlete, because you knew that Nate would be there because he had a really high FTP. If you can have a really high FTP to just absorb and to just like sit in patrol and be there, then like Ivy said, like a 1 minute sprint would be horrendously long for anybody. But even if you did a 30-second sprint, a 20-second sprint, that's a long sprint in the game of cycling. And that's what you're best at. So like Ivy said, it's about lengthening that sort of sprint and getting to the point where you can actually utilize that. And I don't want to race you. If you get to 380 watts, oh my gosh, I do not want to race you with that sort of sprint and that ability. Oh,
you would be winning Cat 1. If you had like a good brain for cycling, you'd win Cat 1 races that have no... Oh. Acceleration and no hills, because that's if they have those, it's going to be hard. But if it's just a flat, like a four corner crit thing, you'd be killing it. That's a really good point, John, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super excited for you though, Michael. Like this is the kind of athlete that comes from traditional sport and knows what it is like to really suffer, that gets a lot out of bike racing and about the learning process. And I think you're going to have a lot of fun with it.
Swimmers always kill it, right?
Yeah, and they suffer like nobody else. Imagine sprinting and having to hold your breath. Like, go and do your sweet sprint that you do and then don't breathe. Like, and Michael, it's just like, and swim into a wall at the end of it. Like, it's just wild. Yeah.
Michael, you're going to be able to train up your sprint again too, very quickly. Your sprint's going to go away and then get that FTP up and just focus on that. And then 6-8 weeks before, like, work on that sprint again. And I bet you'll end up with a much, much better position. That is sprinting to a whole bunch, it's like neuromuscular fatigue, like your brain gets tired. It's a whole different type of tired. And you don't need to be really sharp and have a, 1800 watt 6 second sprint. Jeez Louise. that's like, that's world the tour like level, but 100% that's because you're stacked with muscle
and you're fresh and
you have a 250 watt FTP, where if you build that up, you're going to lose some muscle probably. But also, you won't have to be able to 380. You'll probably be down to you know, 340 or 330 if you lose some weight too. But there's the balance that you're going to do. It's going to be amazing. And tell us what happens.
Yeah. I'm just expressing like curiosity here, Nate, but I really want to look into studies to see if they've looked at like CO2 clearance for swimmers and see if it's like, or tolerance, sorry, for swimmers, and see if they've developed that like substantially better. And then if that can cross over into other sports, like I want to see if there's studies on that, because that would be fascinating. Cause that's one of the things that, that you have to be good at when you swim, is that tolerating that sort of CO2 accumulation from your muscles working so hard. You don't have to be, John. Sorry. Yeah.
If you're fast.
I drink the pool when I swim. So yeah, I wouldn't know. So yeah. Okay. Now on the totally other side of the spectrum, Chris says, I recently started cycling after a lifetime of rock climbing. I climbed at a high level for years, including a 3-year competition stint. Mm-hmm. I've always been on the shorter side at 5'9". So 5'9". Oh gosh, maybe one of you can do that math and see what it is. And
short
king.
No, I'm just kidding. That's not short. It's fine.
It's not short. But for rock climbers, you know, it might be a little shorter. Hmm. My strength was always brought into light. Thanks, Nate. Awesome. My strength was always brought into light when climbs were long and physically demanding. I've effectively had to give up climbing for 9 months now due to elbow issues, but I found a huge passion for cycling, particularly climbing at a weight of 131 pounds. So it's a climber build, right? 5'9", 131 mm-hmm. pounds. The challenge is when I look on Strava, I seem to be good on short climbs, even snagging a few KOMs on sub-1-minute climbs. But I joined a local group ride last week and I got dropped before we even got to the climbs, then waited for the group when they were doing their second lap on in the climbs, and I got dropped again after a minute on a 5% climb. So my question, and I hope this can be read when Nate is on, what would Nate do with his notoriously thorough approach to make me the best cyclist I can be? Many thanks for the hours of entertainment and facilitating my new obsession.
Mm-hmm. Let's go with Chris has, the info we have with Chris. Chris has recently started cycling after a lifetime of rock climbing. Rock climbers, their strength is insane. Like
nuts.
I saw this video of like, it was like the big bodybuilders challenged a rock climber to do some like pulls and stuff. And he was doing the same weight. Yeah. I was
like, it's like crazy a guy that looks like the strongest man on the world. And then a very like, very, you know, they're strong looking, average, but average looking person, relatively mm-hmm. speaking. And they can
average fit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane.
Effectively, I had to give up climbing for 9 months due to elbow issues. Give up climbing doesn't necessarily mean you need to, that I never climbed, like, and I got my FTP up to 360 something. I don't remember. Somewhere up there, really
I think
high.
He's saying climbing. I think he's rock saying climbing. Climbing, like rock climbing. Yep. I had to give up rock climbing for 9 months. That makes sense. The elbow issues. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And, huge passion for cycling, 131 pounds. Now, with this, I wish I knew your watt kg or your, what it is, because like you're brand new, and man, brand new, the drop right here dropped left and right every time, all the time. Even, and when you say you're good, better at short sub 1 minute climbs, I think you don't even know what you're good at yet, because you're under, your whole system's underdeveloped. Not, you have a lot of potential that's untapped. That's a better way to put it, is you got to put in some many months and on the trainer road and, get those, get that FTP up so that all these surges don't hurt so much. And then that's going to help you too on the climbs. And then when you get, you know, you can, once you have baseball specialty and you get some anaerobic work there too, and general build and stuff, so that you can kind of, even these repeated hits hurt even less, and you can kind of snap onto things and get in, aerodynamic position or you're drafting again. But that's, I mean, that's what it is. Like, be consistent, eat carbs. Don't be afraid of that. I know you're 131. So sometimes I've seen that, like, some of the lightest people have the most, like they're so scared to gain weight. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be slower. And two, when you're like building your FTP, I'd be even less concerned. When you get up to like 4.5 watts per kilo, it depends on your age too, but, that would be really, really, really high. Like one of the top people, and you will go like, you want to lose 3 pounds, maybe then try it. But by fueling your body all the way through, that FTP is going to go up so much faster than trying to like mm-hmm. hold that 131. And your legs are going to get bigger too. You probably shed some upper body weight, and who knows what that will happen. And I wouldn't stress about the weight or even about getting dropped in this, because I bet you these people have cycled for way longer than you. And you might think too, I was a rock climber, so that means I should be fit, because you destroy them in rock climbing. It's not transferable. And even some aerobic sports, it does help. Like swimmers, they'll come faster. rock climbing isn't aerobic enough, in my opinion, to really have, you probably have grit and termination and all the, like those kind of skills that you need, but not the many years of aerobic engine build.
Conditioning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like rock climbing events are going to be pretty short, like relatively speaking. We're talking on the time course of, if even if it's a long one, it's going to be like a minute, maybe 2 minutes. I don't know, something like that. I could be ignorant here, so let me know if I am in comments on YouTube. Let me know if there are ones that are longer than that. But typically, it's not going to be a very long thing. So long is relative to the sport for sure. By the way, 131 pounds is 59 kilograms. Ivy, sorry, I jumped in on you.
No, that's okay. Okay, Chris, I know you're competitive. I know you lost this thing that you want, that you were competitive in, and you are probably trying to mm-hmm. reassign that competition to cycling. And I know exactly the kind of person that, that does this. And you're like looking at yourself and you're like, I'm light. I'm an athlete. Why aren't I hanging with these people? And I think the worst thing you can do right now is make any sort of competition to these people on these group rides. Maybe don't do these race group rides for a little bit. Do group rides, learn from other cyclists. But I think the competition that you need to have right now with cycling is with yourself, to work on your form, to learn from other cyclists about eating on the bike, form on the bike, positioning, all this, all these like soft skills that when you compare yourself to other riders on a group ride that are dropping you, you have no idea how long they've been riding. You can't just like look at weight, at your weight and your build and be like, I should be a good climber. What's wrong? And as soon as you start comparing yourself, even on Strava, like it's not going to make you want to be in the sport for a long time. It's going to make you just like constantly compare yourself to other people in a negative way without all that context of how long they've been training, how long they've been riding, how well they know this race course or these climbs and how perfectly they're pacing it. It's just not going to make you happy. And I know you're so inclined to reassign this competition to something new. And you can still do that. You can still be competitive, but your competition has to be about you and challenging yourself and how much you can raise your FTP and be a better athlete singularly before you start kind of adding the racing against other people element. Do you guys agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Nate.
One extra thing on that is if he didn't mention this, but the structured intervals, like, if you're just riding with friends and stuff and you jump over to structured training, hopefully with Trainer Road, obviously,
yeah.
The amount of improvement you will get.
There is no Trainer Road account. So yeah. Good point. Sign up.
the amount that you will improve and how quickly it will be insane relative to what the amount of effort you're putting in now. It could be the exact same amount of effort. You're just going to pop up really fast. And what Ivy said, you know, it's almost January, a month of like doing that. It makes group rides safer too, because you're, instead of being gassed the whole time, you mm-hmm. can still learn. You do need to learn those soft skills and stuff too. But you can have all the soft skills in the world and you don't have, you know, if you're at 2 watts per kilo, you're probably going to get dropped every single time. You'd be the best bike handler in the world. The real bread and butter is the FTP getting up there. And then obviously there's a minimum level of safety that you need.
Mm. Yes. And if you're boxed and exhausted, to your point, Nate, you can't learn anything and he can't be safe. Yeah, it's super important. Maybe he just needs to shave his legs. You know, he's coming in this new, like he doesn't know, like cyclists. I'm just joking. But in this case, so most climbers that I know don't gravitate toward competitions. The rock climbers that do competitions are seemingly rare amongst the climbing population. So Chris, you probably understand this whole perspective of like, okay, I need to go do something repeatedly and I need to build because I've got some sort of objective that I'm working to, rather than just going out and, you know, sending some sort of a line that you've been working on for a while, fixing, you know, like, or working on some sort of bouldering problem and that's the whole thing. Instead, it's like, I want to improve because I have a competition, so I've got to hit these benchmarks. So I think that structured training would really resonate with you and probably help a lot. But blending the two of them, you can do, I don't know where you live. A lot of rock climbers live in cold, wintry environments in the winter, but you could blend the two. I know a lot of climbers like to be outside and amongst beautiful nature and everything else. And you can do all of your trainer road workouts outside too. If you have a head unit and a power meter, get some Garmin pedals. That's like a super easy, accessible way to have a power meter. Boom, you've got it. And then, you can swap it from bike to bike even, and you can do all your training that way. It's just a really good experience. So I think you'll catch on to it quick. As an athlete that's 131 pounds, even if you put on a little bit of weight, your FTP is never going to be too high. So here's what I would say moving forward. That means that you have to be the king of efficiency and self-control. Like, you have to be the sort of rider that doesn't respond to everything, that knows when to keep the powder dry. Whereas an athlete that has a huge FTP, they can get away with riding with more aggression and less care and I guess less of a cautious approach to how they use their power. You won't have that. But that means that you get to be a tactician and you get to be very choosy about when you use that sort of thing and very precise. Probably aligns with a lot of the approach that you do with climbing. You have to be so precise. So that probably is going to work really well with just like your psychology and how it works. But just always know that with a smaller FTP, just because of wind resistance and everything else, you will always find yourself in situations if you're riding with a group, racing with a group, where you will have to be very careful about how you use your power. Because while some person's riding at threshold, you'll be riding VO2. Or while they're riding tempo, you'll be riding threshold. So it's complicated. Unless you get on steep stuff, then you're in your realm. But everywhere else, drafting, you have to be really careful. Yeah. Even then, when you're drafting, sometimes I've been drafting behind big guys like you, Nate, and you have really big FTPs, and we're rolling at like 36 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour through a flat or something like that with a tailwind. And it's hard for me to hold that speed on your wheel because for me, I'm at 300 watts and that's roughly my threshold. Meanwhile, you're at 360 watts and you still haven't hit your threshold, right? So it can be tricky.
A big part of that is what you just said is the tailwind, because when there is the aerodynamic drag, you can hide, or there's a crosswind and you can't like echelon out. That's the other part. Mm-hmm. But I think of like, the great sprinter in Reno.
Jose.
Think about him.
Yeah.
He's probably around this size. And he just hide. He doesn't have an extremely high FTP. For Chris, 4 watts per kilo, for everyone at 131 is 236 watt FTP. So, another case too, where you might be better gaining some weight and you can still be at 4 watts per kilo, but also it's always better to be at that 4 watts per kilo and then also be away a little bit more, because then you have more watts, into what John said, more watts to use in different situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Fun questions today. Thanks for submitting them. Everybody that's listening to this, if you haven't submitted a question, go and do that. Go to trainerroad.com/podcast. This is how the podcast continues, with the questions that you have, but it really continues because you all signed up for Trainer Road, and we're appreciative of all of you that are doing that. If you haven't signed up yet, you listen to this around Christmas, treat yourself, get yourself a Christmas present, or for somebody else, you can do that too. Sign them up for Trainer Road, share the word with your friends, and we will talk to you next time with a special episode of sorts for the new year. Thanks y'all. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.